This episode of Show Me the Meaning is brought to you by Nordic Track and Mubi. What's up, everyone? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecrack's movie podcast.
Show me the meaning!
My name is Jared, and with me is the Show Me the Meaning crew. We got Ryan.
Hey, film fans.
And Austin.
Hello.
And joining us from the Projection Booth podcast, the ultimate movie podcast, Mike White. How's it going, Mike?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Doing good.
Doing so awesome.
I was on Mike's podcast recently. It hasn't come out yet, but we talked about the Michael Haneke movie, The Piano Teacher, which I ashamedly told him on his podcast that I'd seen four times. So definitely check out Mike's podcast. Thanks for coming with us, Mike, on this journey to talk about The Shining.
Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. All right, guys. So before we start talking about The Shining, which is the movie we're going to be talking about today, a couple things I want to go over. First of all, gonna have another call to you guys. Please give us a review on iTunes. If everyone listening to this spent 3 minutes giving us a review on iTunes, it would basically change our lives. So if you guys have the 3 minutes, it would be super epic if you guys left us a review. Other thing I want to reveal is we did another poll on our Patreon, which is at wisecrackplus.com, about what our patrons want us to talk about for the next movie. And so Ryan picked two films, Austin picked two films, and I picked two films, and the results are in. So first let me list off the two films.
The suspension has been killing me.
You mean the suspense?
I really, yeah, whatever. I came to win. I came to win, and I hope I won.
All right.
Reveal it.
All right, do you guys want to say, okay, the two movies that I picked Akira and I picked Batman v Superman. Okay. What movies did you pick, Ryan?
I picked Starship Troopers and I picked Human Centipede First Sequence.
And Austin?
I picked Pain and Gain and Antichrist.
Okay.
Oh my
God. You guys ready for the results?
Yeah.
Do you want me to go in order or from top to bottom to top?
Go from bottom to top.
Yeah, bottom to top.
Okay.
Yeah. We got the least.
All right. In last place with 18 votes is Pain and Gain.
What the?
Hey, oh, man, I like that movie.
People, y'all don't understand. This is Michael Bay's
underrated
Stalker. Come on.
All right. Mike, have you seen that movie?
I have. That is one of the few Michael Bay's I really like.
See?
You know, I actually haven't seen it.
Oh, dude.
That's interesting to hear that. Okay. And all right. So next one with 21 votes, the second to last place is Austin, sorry, bro, Antichrist.
Oh, no!
What the fuck, man?
I'm with you on that one. I'm with you on that one. Oh, I fucking
man,
love
I made it.
I
made
love
it
Antichrist.
One-third of the way through.
If I got the last two, and we're watching Batman versus Superman, I'm going to fucking jump out
pissed
my window. That's all I'm saying.
I'm going to be pissed.
Have you seen Batman versus Superman yet?
Yes, I've seen it. Well, I saw 45
Oh, you have?
We've gone through
oh, you
this.
Have. Okay, all right,
this movie
all right
sucks.
Okay, all right. Next, in third from last place...
Fourth
from last place, excuse me, is with 28 votes, Human Centipede.
Boo! What's wrong with you?
Hey, man, they did better than Antichrist in Pain and Gain.
I guess, but all right.
All right, third place with 30 votes.
It was ahead of its time.
Is Batman v Superman.
Good.
Thank God.
All right, and this is actually, it's kind of a squeaker between the first and second place.
Oh,
second
no
place with 52 votes is Starship
no
Troopers.
Fuck me, God.
That means number one with 58 votes
Akira
is Akira. So,
okay, well, that's cool.
That is cool. So last week I was sick. We were supposed to be talking
squeaker
about Gone Girl, so we ended up not doing that. We actually ended up releasing a patron-only thing that was supposed to be for our patrons only, which was on the Star Wars backlash, but because I got sick, we just were like, well, shit, we don't have something to upload. So we just uploaded that. So
that turned out awesome, by the way.
Oh, thank you. So for those of you who are not patrons, you got a little taste of what we usually give to our patrons. So if you're interested in more stuff like that, check out wisecrackplus.com. Anyway, all right, guys. So today we're talking about the 1980 film The Shining, starring Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall, directed by the man, Stanley Kubrick. So let's go ahead and get some first impressions. Let's start this time with Austin. Tell us about this movie, Austin.
So this might be surprising. This is the first time I've actually ever seen The Shining.
The fuck?
Oh, my God.
Wow. I know. I feel like I already had seen it just by watching clips or watching documentaries about it, including Room 237, which I think is kind of awesome.
Whoa, you watched Room 237 before you watched The Shining?
Homie, I've read so much about
what's wrong
this movie
with you, Austin?
That I feel like I've seen it. You know?
Okay.
There was nothing in
I
it
guess
that surprised me. That didn't mean I still didn't enjoy it, but literally I've read so much about it and seen so many clips on it and video essays, and I've read people talking about themes in it that it was like I had seen the movie. So I never was interested because I was like, I get it, you know? So this was the first time I'd seen it, and I kind of agree with everything I just said, and in a way I'm also kind of wrong because it sort of supersedes even all of those analyses and things like that, because the tension that's built and the sort of thematic resonance that's built throughout the 2.5 hours is really lovely. And so I have thoughts, I will say, but I think it's fan fucking tastic.
All right, cool. Mike, what about you?
I have seen this movie before, and it is always great to return to. I don't know how many times I've seen it over the years. This is I have told this story before, but this is one of the few films that ever made me viscerally sick the first time that I saw it. It wasn't I didn't throw up, but I got a really bad headache, and I think it was that high-pitched Shining noise. When that would come on, I would just kind of freak out.
Okay, awesome. Ryan?
Yeah, I've seen this movie like probably a dozen times in my life, and it's one of those few movies that I really do believe is totally different in the movie theater, because I saw probably like the first 5 times just at home, and I loved it. I always, every time it's an A+, but in the theater it was such a crazy experience. I felt the tension way more, kind of that sick feeling you're talking about. I definitely was more terrorized when I watched it with a whole group of people in a dark theater. So that's what I would say about that movie, is that watching it this time for like the dozenth time back at home, I was kind of like, man, this movie was really way better in a movie theater, even though I still loved it.
How many times have you seen it in the theater?
Twice.
I think I was there with you once at the Egyptian. Yeah.
Yeah. And how awesome was that? You know?
And yeah, that was awesome.
Do you agree with me?
I agree with you. Yeah. I mean, I like this movie a lot. It's definitely not top tier Kubrick for me.
For me, it is. I think it's strangely more accessible movies. And
is not top tier Kubrick still top tier in American, well, I guess he's British, but we'll say Western cinema, or does it kind of fall out of the top category?
He is a Brooklynite. He's as American as they come. I don't give a shit if he moved to London, you know, in his later years.
Didn't he talk with an accent though?
No, I think
really.
He sounds like just a regular dude.
Does he? Okay. Yeah. Okay.
A regular American dude.
Yeah, surprisingly.
A dude, you know?
What about you, Jared?
Yeah, I mean, I, you know, it's funny, like, part of the reason we're doing this is because next month, the second episode of our new pilot show, The Film Tourist, in which I talk about, like, film form while inhabiting the scene of movies, is on The Shining. And I watched the movie so many times for that it kind of didn't really do anything for me this run. But like Ryan, I had this very pure memory in my mind of seeing it at the Egyptian, seeing it in a theater, seeing it at a great theater, and how powerful it is. This is one of the most fun movies to think about, but at the same time, I feel like maybe even a lot of this podcast is just going to be calling bullshit on a lot of stuff. Because by the way, I know we can do Room 237 for another podcast, but Ryan knows my feelings about that movie. I fucking hate that movie.
I fucking love that movie.
I hate it.
I love it.
Room 237 is a movie that totally, it's just a documentary about the wrong subject. It shouldn't, like, what's interesting about Room 237 is that you have these people making these outlandish jumps of logic, and the interesting question is, who the fuck are these people? But we never see their faces. We never see these individuals.
What a bold choice.
Yeah, a bold choice doesn't mean it's a good choice.
That was interesting.
But anyway, all right, let's go into a recap, and then I can't wait to talk to you guys about, I'm curious, how much of the Room 237 stuff do you guys buy? How much of it do you think is BS? What meanings do you actually walk away with from this movie?
59.4%. We'll get into it.
Okay. All right, guys, on to the recap. So, teacher-turned-frustrated writer Jack Torrance, along with his wife Wendy and young son Danny, arrive at the Overlook Hotel, where they will work as the hotel's caretakers for the winter. Before Jack is handed the keys, he's warned that the previous caretaker lost his mind and killed his family. Meanwhile, Danny meets the cook Halloran, who shares a specific telepathic ability with Danny called Shining. Halloran warns him about Room 237 and then leaves for the winter. Despite Halloran's warning, Danny's curiosity brings him to Room 237. Meanwhile, Jack is having horrible nightmares and becomes increasingly irritable. When Danny reappears, apparently beaten, Wendy blames it on Jack. Furious at the accusation, Jack drinks for the first time in years and starts to see apparitions. Then he witnesses a disturbing image in Room 237 and starts losing his sanity. Jack attends a 1920s-style party in the Gold Room where he meets Dilbert Grady, the previous caretaker who killed his family. Grady informs Jack that Danny is using his abilities to call Halloran back to the hotel and that Jack should correct them as he did his family. Meanwhile, Danny, under the guise of his imaginary friend Tony, starts writing red rum on the walls. By the time Halloran shows up, Jack is rampaging through the halls trying to track down and kill Danny and Wendy. Jack kills Halloran and pursues Danny through the hedge maze on the outskirts of the hotel. Danny tricks Jack, then he gets lost and freezes to death overnight while Danny and Wendy escape to safety. The final image shows a track-in on a photo hanging in the halls of the Overlook Hotel of Jack enjoying the 4th of July ball in 1921. End of movie. All right, guys. Now, before we move on, I want to give a shout-out to our sponsors over at Mubi. So, what is Mubi? Mubi is a digital cinema. Basically, there are a certain number of movies playing for 30 days, and then once those 30 days are up, the movie goes away. So, there are always 30 movies on the site. You have 30 ways to watch a movie, and then after that, it's gone. And each day, Mubi introduces a new gem, and you have 1 month to watch it, whether it's an acclaimed masterpiece, a cult classic, or a film festival darling. There are always 30 perfectly curated movies to discover. Plus, you can also delve deeper into films with the exclusive interviews, video essays, and critical reviews on Mubi's notebook. So you can get a free trial of Mubi for 7 days, but if you head to Mubi.com/wisecrack, you can get an extended 30-day trial. So one of the movies that's playing on Mubi right now that is a classic that I've revisited many times is The Producers, the classic Mel Brooks movie that's been remade on Broadway. And then there's been an adaptation of the Broadway play on the original. But you can't go wrong with the Mel Brooks classic.
Springtime for Hitler.
Springtime for Hitler. Absolutely. And then I think Ryan wanted to talk about a film that's playing
Victoria. If you haven't seen Victoria, it's this German film that was shot in one take. It's like a 2-hour movie. They did it on, I think they had like enough time for 4 takes, and they did it on the third one, or maybe even the last
one.
I don't know.
Something like
read
that.
Read up on it.
I think it's the second to last one. They just kind of picked the best one overall.
Yeah.
It's cool.
And it was, it's a really cool, you know, masterclass in just setting up a take.
All right.
Watch it.
Cool. So if you guys want to try Mubi, go to Mubi.com/wisecrack for a 30-day free trial. That's 30 movies over 30 days. That's Mubi.com/wisecrack for your extended free trial. And back to the show. All right, guys. So there's so much to talk about here. I just want to hear off the bat, just somebody say, like, what reading of this film do you adhere to? Or, like, what do you think is interesting that you've heard? Everyone's heard a million interpretations of this thing.
Well, for anyone not familiar with Room 237, you know, it's basically a bunch of, which is what Jared's referencing, there's a whole bunch of conspiracy theories about Stanley Kubrick. One of them is, like, that he was involved in filming the moon landing, and that there's, like, all these subtle hints in the movie.
It really is not that subtle. Danny is wearing a sweatshirt that says Apollo 11 or something like that.
Exactly.
You know?
The pattern on the carpet resembles the Apollo missions logo, and then 237 could be referring to the distance between the Earth and the moon, stuff like that.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, I don't believe in any of
that.
Do
you believe that, Austin?
No, of course not. I do think that it could be possible that there was some sort of doctoring of images. That shit doesn't surprise me at all. Whether it's photographs or that things were filmed on a soundstage, that doesn't surprise me. But I'm not a big conspiracy theory guy because ultimately I don't really care.
I can definitely see Stanley Kubrick literally just trolling the audience by putting
that
Apollo 11 thing in there.
Yeah.
That could be it, too.
Another one is about the Native Americans, right? And something, can you?
Well, so the Native American burial ground is one of the ones. Another one is that it's a commentary on American imperialism. And then another one is that it's secretly about like anti-Semitism. So when Jack does his big bad wolf thing, the wolf is an anti-Semitic character. And so there are all these anti-Semitic themes in there as well. So those are a couple.
That one I've never heard. Yeah. Let's slow down. I want to go over the native.
That's from Room 237.
Oh, really? I saw that movie at Fantastic Fest. I think Ryan was at that same festival that year. And God, I just remember like rolling my eyes this whole time, and I'm like, "Who the fuck are these people?"
I was cracking up, man.
All right. So let's go over the Native American genocide one, just so people are kind of following us with why people think that this is an interpretation of the film. So some people see it as a comment on America's inability to own up to its violent past. So I've heard some people say that the Overlook Hotel is like the hotel itself is a vision of silence. It's like always covering up the past. And, you know, like, so even the guy, what is his name, Ullman, says that it was built on an Indian burial ground, considering the visions of violence that were given from the hotel's past. Oh, he says that, yeah, like, its foundations must be soaked in blood to the core. Like, I think that when the blood pours out of the elevator, everything is drowned, everything is tainted. The name Overlook Hotel suggests that we, like, overlook this catastrophe of our past. I don't really buy this, but another thing, people always back this up by saying that there's Indian-style designs on the wall that Jack is throwing a tennis ball at. When he's stuck in the pantry, there's calomel powder that has an Indian face on the can. There are Indian-style rugs everywhere. I mean, it was built on an Indian burial ground, and I think that at the very least, the production designers realized that, okay, so there's some Native American history here, so we're going to, you know, make the hotel right. have well, that
yeah, and it's modeled. It's modeled after the famous hotel in, what, Yosemite, is it? I can't remember the name of the hotel, but so it's modeled after that, which...
It's the Stanley Hotel in Colorado, or at least that's where... That's the original hotel that Stephen King stayed at that... inspired the book.
Yeah, no.
I don't know right. if that's the same thing that Austin's talking about.
No, it's in like Yosemite. I can't remember the name of the hotel. I can get it in 1 second here, actually. Let's see.
Yeah, I think there was also a hotel in California that inspired some of the look to it as well.
Oh, hold on 2 seconds here. And then the exteriors were based on this hotel in Montana. So the hotel is called the Awanahi Hotel in Yosemite National Park. My parents have actually stayed there. And then, yeah, the Stanley Hotel in Colorado is for the exteriors. But the interiors, which this is a hotel in Yosemite that actually has a lot of Native American art and patterns and things like that. So that doesn't surprise me if he's not trying to make some grand statement about Native American genocide. But he's just trying to emulate the hotel.
Do you think that the fact that the image at the end of the movie is the July 4th ball, you know, like the celebration of American independence, does that add to the credence of this theory at all?
I mean... It could. I think that ultimately someone's trying to force a specificity about something that is far more likely to be just about aggression and violence within human psyche itself. Because we already know that he's a reader of Freud and that he's interested in psychoanalysis. We talked about that in the Eyes Wide Shut episode. I mean, that's not something that in any way I think we would deny. I mean, he's very clear about that, even in interviews, that he was influenced by psychoanalysis. He read a lot of Freud. So for me, the Freudian psychoanalytic, the labyrinthine themes are far more striking than these, like, oh, it's a commentary on this or a commentary on that. It could be, because he obviously wrote Full Metal Jacket, which is a commentary on American imperialism in a lot of ways. So it could have some of these other themes that are more, let's say, political. But I think the psychoanalytic readings are far more interesting.
Yeah, my take on all that is that you're right that Stanley Kubrick is way more into the whole psychoanalytical aspect of the story, but all of these symbolisms is from Stephen King, because Stephen King just, that's what he does. He messes with, you know, big iconography, you know, elements in his stories and then mixes them all together. And so, yeah, he's like, okay, yeah, a guy in a Native American hotel, and like he just mixed all these things up. I think that's basically as deep as it goes with...
Well, from what I remember, that the book is very different from the movie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
They go way into
they
that
added
way
a
more.
Lot of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so
they added a lot more in the movie than they had in the book, is what I'm saying, as far as like the Indian symbolism and stuff. That wasn't necessarily in the book.
And Stanley Kubrick, at least, like, he's just trying to make a scary movie, I think, at the end of the day.
You think?
Sure.
Yeah, I think he's really not putting all that stuff. But right. I do think he's super detailed and made. I do think he put a lot of what do you call it? Like, what's it called when something is when you split a circle in half? Symmetrical. He put a lot of symmetrical stuff in the movie, because if you remember at Fantastic Fest, they literally played The Shining over itself. Like they had it one way superimposed going forward, and then they had it going backwards over itself.
I've heard that.
For 2 hours, and it was scary how much it synced up, you know. Yeah. And so there's all these people, I think, that go into that, you know, kind of have OCD.
I would like to see that again. I would like to hate watch Room 237 again.
You should.
I mean, I think the thing with Room 237 is we're not supposed to take it too seriously. And people who do take it too seriously are obviously looking for something. They're grasping for something. I think that it's like a cultural artifact that's interesting because it muses on potential, like, I don't know, intertextual references or something like that, which I think is a fascinating thought experiment. But I'm not sure we need to invest ourselves in these conspiracy theories or these other like textual resonances. That just seems a little too, I don't know, overenthusiastic and try hard.
Yeah. I mean, to me, the best thing about this movie is definitely the filmmaking technique. I think that it's probably one of the you can see how he very deliberately constructs shots and kind of gives us this ambiguous conclusion as to what exactly is happening in the hotel. But before we
get, what do you think's going on in the film?
Well, I want to just do one more reading that I found interesting before we go into that question of what exactly is happening in the hotel. So this time watching the movie, I noticed something that I don't know how relevant it is. I'm curious to what you guys think, but they talk about there's this awareness of television and media and horror films in this movie. So early on when Jack is being interviewed for the job, he says, "My wife Wendy is a ghost story and horror film addict." And then later when they're driving up, Jack is reacting to the fact that Danny somehow knows what the Donner Party is. And he says, "See, it's okay. He saw it on the television." Mm-hmm. There are some shots where there's the television is at the center of the frame. There's a shot where Danny is watching Roadrunner and he's like transfixed. And then I think you could make a really good argument that as Jack gets crazier, he talks more and more like a TV character. Of course, there's "Wendy, I'm home." And of course, here's Johnny. "Not by the hair on your chinny chin chin, then I'll huff and I'll puff." And, you know, when you think about this movie came out in 1980, and I think that there was a big horror film boom that kind of led up to this. So I guess my question for you guys is, do you think that there is almost a reactionary element to this movie, that the movie's kind of reacting to the popular horror cinema that preceded it, that probably even allowed this movie to get made because horror cinema was so effective and successful, and it even is today?
It's true. Halloween was, what, 3 years before this?
I've actually not seen Halloween.
No. I mean, I think you're right that it was riding a wave that we haven't talked about yet. It's true.
And then
I want to say Halloween was 78. So yeah, between that and then the quick follow-ups of like Friday the 13th and those kind of things. I mean, slashers were in vogue, and this one, it's kind of is the slasher, like the way that Wendy's holding her knife and everything. But really, once we break out the axe, then it becomes that. Even though with all the shit going on in this movie, there's what, one guy that dies, Mr. Halloran dies, and then Jack.
That's right. That's a good point. I think that there are some, it definitely inverts a lot of these horror tropes that those slasher movies relied on. So for example, like the axe through the door scene. I mean, most, if this were a slasher in the tradition of the films that built up to this, it would build suspense until Wendy kind of goes in the bathroom, then she would relax until she feels safe and the audience feels safe. And then suddenly, without warning, the axe would come crashing through the door and the audience would jump like a jump scare. That's what happens in slasher films. But with this one, we know where Jack is. We know that he's approaching the door. We know he's about to, you know, so instead of having us be scared with Wendy, I mean, we are scared with Wendy, but for different reasons. Like, it definitely, instead of having Jack be like Jason or Freddy Krueger, who are these mysterious characters that we're never with their perspective, he definitely tries something a bit more radical and shows us from the beginning we are with the perspective of the person who becomes the monster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this film, remember how I was a little bit turned off by Hereditary's turn at the end of the film, because I thought it sort of rationalized what was otherwise, I thought, a nice mystery and tension building exploration of, you know, psychological depths and trauma and things like that within the human experience. This film doesn't do that. And so that's why this film is far more interesting, because one, it's not like, oh, here's a monster that's coming to get you like the slasher films are. And then it's also not, here's some sort of spiritual occultish thing that rationalizes everything. You're still left at the end kind of like, the fuck is going on? Even there's all that talk about The Shining, and there are these people that are able to tap into the future and the past, and that the building itself, that the hotel itself sort of has this shining resonant possibility as well. All of that is still very unexplained, and I really like that because I like confusion. Yeah.
I think the scariest monsters are the ones that we know, the monster you know, and so much of this movie is about family and family relationships, and that the father, that Jack is the monster, that Charles / Delbert Grady is a monster. I mean, this, so much of this is about just those horrible moments of family and the tension that happens, and that we have this history of abuse from Jack to Danny, and then the way that Jack treats Wendy. I mean, those are the scenes that make your skin crawl. Like when she comes in and he just lays into her, verbally abusing her, that's like almost as bad as a knife point.
Mm. Yeah, because the real monsters are projections of the worst parts of humanity, right? Or the things that humans are scared of, or the things that humans are trying to reconcile with. And this film is all about the monster that's inside of you, the monster that's inside your brain. And so that's why, even though Room 237 has those weird conspiracy ones, the one that I find the most interesting is probably the one where they say that it's about the Minotaur, because the idea of the labyrinth and the maze and the Minotaur seems to be something that Kubrick was very intentionally employing as a motif.
I mean, the Minotaur design thing, like, there's a maze, but as far as it being like Minotaur, Theseus, like, I just don't buy it. Like, yes, there is a maze. I think you could make a good argument that it's the maze-like structure of the brain, but I remember this part in 237. I think this is where I lost my shit, where they're like focusing on this poster that is very clearly a poster showing a guy skiing, and they're like, oh, but if you look at
the
Minotaur. Shadow makes it look like a Minotaur.
No, I didn't
I was
like that part.
I wanted to get up and fucking leave.
Yeah. No, that's, they're obviously forcing. So let's say that, again, even when we watch Room 237, we don't take them literally. Maybe they want to be taken literally, but at least what they're noticing is this theme of the Minotaur, which I think is fascinating. Because even if a boring representation of the Minotaur story would be a literal, here's a story of a Minotaur and Theseus who goes in, and it's Ariadne and all of these characters. That's the boring, okay, great, we get it, representational art, blah, 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 blah. This is 2018, let's be interesting. Or if this is 1980, let's be interesting. Even still, like, representational art has existed for centuries, so we don't need to reproduce something that's a few millennia old. So the interesting way to look at it is just to take a motif and to insert it into this larger set of thematics where it's about human psychology, it's about family, it's about trauma, it's about male fragility and resentment because his wife is just this sperm bank that's not giving him the satisfaction that he desires, which is why he has that weird interaction with the woman in 237 at that one point, right? And so there
it's
are
about
all these
people in bear costumes blowing guys.
The look on his face when he sees that woman in 237, like, you know, there is not even a second of thought of like, oh, you know, but maybe I shouldn't cheat on my wife. Like,
no.
He's just like in it. Like, he's just like, I am ready to submit myself to fantasy.
Absolutely. And so I think when you look at the idea of Theseus and Minotaur as being maybe Danny and Jack at the end, that we don't need to expect that it would be such a literal rendition, but that it has these nice thematic motifs that are a part of it. And I think that's interesting.
Yeah. So just to cap off my rant on Room 237, I would say that the movie would be more interesting if these people said one could interpret this as a Minotaur, but they don't say that. They say it's a Minotaur. And then I asked myself, who the fuck is this guy saying this? Like, it's like some sort of authoritative statement. And then I don't get the answer to that question. And I'm like, this documentary is not asking
the
right question.
But the structure of the movie, though, is literally you just hear a new guy's voice every 10 minutes.
Right.
You know, a new theory. Didn't you just get the idea like, okay, this is this guy's opinion. So I didn't get the authoritative aspect of the movie because they don't structure like that. It's not like a History Channel documentary on The Shining.
How is it not?
Like, it's not, because it's just literally just like, here's Room 237, and then here's one crazy person talking about a crazy theory, and then another.
But that whole crazy, you're projecting that.
I am projecting it, but I think Austin said
it earlier.
If there
was an authoritative voice that, like, you know, like that painted these people as crazy, then at least there'd be a sense of perspective.
But they did that on purpose, though. They did it. They said, we're going to let the audience come up with whatever they come up. And you obviously are like, fuck these people. They're bullshitting us. And I'm like, man, I want to know what these people are like, too. But I'm glad that I only got their 5-minute take on The Shining.
All right. I want to move on. But the last thing I'll say is all I wanted was to see these people's faces. I wanted to see who they are, what their day
it's
jobs are.
It's cooler that you don't.
Yeah. So you can judge them because they're dressed weird, Jared? Is that what it is? is?
Exactly.
And then delegitimate them based on the funky hat that the guy is wearing?
Exactly.
I don't need to see them to delegitimize them. What they're saying is absurd.
And
so
that's
that,
what's
that,
cool.
That,
you're,
that
basing it, you're basing it solely on what they said.
Right, but if they were wearing a suit and they said, my name is Dr. So-and-so from the psychology department and film department,
absolutely.
Then, no?
Then I would... No, then I'd be scared to death for our universities.
They're all 13-year-old kids.
So, guys, before we move on, I want to give a shout-out to our sponsors over at Nordic Track. So, Nordic Track, it is workout equipment. Sometimes it's hard to find time to go to the gym. I would know because I find it hard to find time to go to the gym. We've all got a busy schedule. Waking up early in the morning really sucks. If you're in a big city like me, going and finding parking at a gym after just getting up is
the worst.
Just really hard to motivate yourself. Yeah, it's really hard to motivate yourself.
And you got to pay like $20 for it or something like that.
Yeah, and getting a trainer is especially super time-consuming and costly. So with Nordic Track, basically the gym comes to you. It's got a series of training equipment that can give you an amazing workout in the convenience of your own home. So I'm talking treadmills, exercise bikes, incline trainers, strength trainers. You can even join streamed workouts at any time of the day. So you don't need a trainer because you could just hop on your computer, hop on your phone, and get a workout and go along with these people. And you don't even have to feel like you're doing it alone. So you can join these workouts in the streets of Paris or in the shores of Thailand or work out in the African safari. They give you tons of options. One thing I like is I like that they have a treadmill that doubles as a standing desk because I sit way too much. And if you can get a workout in and get work done, then you're pretty much killing it. So they're offering Wisecrack listeners $75 off your Nordic Track purchase. So you guys got to visit nordictrack.com/showme and using the offer code showme. Again, that's nordictrack.com/showme. Use the offer code showme during checkout to get $75 off your purchase. All right, guys, back to the show. All right, so now let's just open the question. What do you guys have any definitive ideas or thoughts as to what is going on in the hotel? We already heard what Austin said.
Mike?
Oh man, put me on the spot. you guys were talking about the idea of the half a circle before, and I love the idea of all the doubling of stuff that's going on in here. The idea of Danny having Tony, his imaginary friend, and then Jack having, is it Delbert at this point, Grady as his imaginary friend, and just the way that we have these mirrors, and so much of this movie and the original ending of this movie was kind of that cycle of violence that I was talking about earlier with abuse, and that the tennis ball that Jack has is, you know, rolling towards Danny in the hallway. And then at the very end of the film, we see him bouncing the ball against a wall, just like his father was. Now that's, you know, obviously cut out, but then we also talk about cycles as well, as far as you've always been the caretaker. You know, this is, you know, maybe Delbert Grady is a different person than Charles Grady. You know, maybe there's a like an imaginary version of him. And this is, you know, this whole idea of all of these things have happened before and they will continue happening until the end of time. So that's why every night in the Gold Room, we're going to have this party going on and it's just going to repeat itself. So, I mean, there's those kind of things are what I enjoy about this movie, is that it opens up so many different avenues that you can pursue and say, oh, look at this. You know, there's doublings of the maze outside and then the maze of the actual overlook itself. There's doublings of, you know, this design versus this design. So it's really nice to take those pieces and try to fit them together. And this is such a nice puzzle that you can put it together in different orientations. It's not always, you know, put in most puzzles, you can only fit the pieces one way. In this, they interlock in many different ways.
Cool. Ryan?
I mean,
like, you know, when you've seen the movie a bunch of times, if somebody asks you, like, hey, man, what is The Shining about? Or, like, you know, what happens? Like, explain the movie to me. What would you say?
Well, I mean, to me, what does the hotel represent? It's isolation is kind of the best word I'd say. Mm-hmm. A guy, like, the whole movie is, you know, it's a fucking big-ass mansion. It'd be different choice if it was just in a little shack, you know, right? It wouldn't be, I don't know.
Yeah, if it was the Bates Motel, it'd be a lot different than the
Overlook
Motel.
That's all I got, really. Yeah. Movies about isolation.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
going crazy.
I think those are both really interesting ways of looking at it. And I don't disagree with either of them. I actually think they get enfolded into the way that I think the most interesting way to read it is. But I think it's a film about the commentary on the human psyche. I know I said this before, but I think that in a way you could say that The Hotel is sort of a visual representation or visual metaphor for the human psyche itself. And so this idea of repetition, like Mike was just talking about, is the idea of the repetitions of the violence and the traumas that are embedded within the human psyche, and that it's related to murder and death, which is very Freudian, this idea of the killing of the primal father, which you obviously have these tensions with the father and the son and the kind of denial of death and red rum and these like seas of blood that are kind of flowing. And so I think that death and murder and trauma are essential at this hotel. And then, of course, you see all the skeletons and the cobwebs. So there's all these themes that seem to imply long periods of time, death, traumatic elements, skeletons in the closet. And I think that those are really kind of quite striking to me. And I think that's why I say the most interesting way to read the film is through the lens of like a Freudian psychoanalytic reading about the human unconscious itself, and that Jack and Danny and Wendy are just sort of, you know, they're just singularities that repeat within this same cycle of violence.
One of the things that I really enjoy about the movie is just looking at, you know, we were talking about perspectives before, and the use of the Steadicam in this movie is so fantastic.
Yes.
That it gives you this free-floating perspective. And sometimes it feels like it's the hotel itself. Other times it feels like you're looking through a character's POV. Mm. There's one point, I think, when he's going into the room to see the beautiful woman / hag, again, another nice doubling, and he opens up the door and you see his hand push it open. So it's very much like Jack's POV mm. and the way that she's framed in there, almost like a proscenium. And then he walks into it. So it can't be his POV, or maybe it's his POV for a little bit, but then the camera stays outside and he moves into it from the left-hand side. So it really throws you off as far as, I thought this was a POV shot. Now suddenly it's an impassive camera
shot.
Maybe
it's our POV, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Huh. No, I think what Mike is touching on is exactly what I was going to go into. Actually, this is the subject of our film tourist episode that's coming out next month. It's all about how Kubrick plays with perspective to basically, and I would say maybe this is a cop-out, I mean, I'd say he basically is just fucking with us.
That's my whole theory on the movie, too. He's just an OCD person who is playing with other OCD people.
Well, it's like he does that bit with the mirror shot with when Jack is sleeping the first time that he wakes up in the hotel. And you think that the shot is on him, but as it pulls out, it starts to turn out that that's actually just his reflection. And then the whole scene plays out in the reflection, except for Wendy when she first walks in. She walks in the shot, and then she goes into the reflection. And so that kind of reverses the angle, and it's jarring. It's sort of like, you know, when directors fuck with the 180-degree rule, right? It's doing something like that where it jars the audience. So you're like, wait a second, what am I looking at?
How many mirrors are in this movie?
So
I mean,
many.
It's crazy how many mirrors. And then even when he first sees Lloyd and he's looking at himself, basically, and then we get that head-on shot from him and he puts his hands over his eyes and then he pulls it down and then he starts to talk to us, but then it's actually now again Lloyd's POV. So it's like, whoa, just he is really pulling the rug out from under you.
Yeah, so I was going to talk about that shot. So we think we're seeing Lloyd from his perspective. And so the conclusion that we could draw from that is, okay, if we're seeing this from Jack's perspective, then we can assume that this is all some sort of subjective delusion and that he's losing his mind. But just when we're about to think that, the shot, the camera goes back and it reveals Jack Torrance's like shoulder. It becomes a close-up to a over-the-shoulder shot as if to give it more objectivity. It fucks with you. It says like, oh, you think this is subjective? Nope. It's objective. Like, it's really happening. And this happens constantly. And the Steadicam thing that Mike brought up, and this was the first use of the Steadicam, right?
No, it had been used before.
He did in Paths of Glory, too, right? Through the barracks?
Yeah. Yeah, that was through with dollies, but he Steadicam. Garrett Brown had done stuff with Bound for Glory, the one about with David Carradine,
Woody Guthrie.
Yeah, Woody Guthrie, and then also the famous step sequence in Rocky, and then also a lot of work on Exorcist 2, and kind of also the pulling the POV of the demon Pazuzu in that film.
Mm.
Interesting.
Awesome. See, you got to check out this guy's podcast. He knows his shit.
Speaking of, I have one of those weird shots for you. Who lets him out of the freezer?
Exactly. This is when it's not even just like perspective, but the physical laws are thrown out the window because, like, okay, if Grady is an apparition, how can he affect physical reality?
Exactly.
And somehow he's let out of the freezer.
And what's your answer to that, Jared? Show me the meaning.
Well, it's a joke. It's not a joke. It's Kubrick just fucking with us. You know,
all
like
right,
the idea. The idea that there is like, he's scaring us by thwarting our efforts to impose meaning or some sort of concrete logic to the film or the hotel.
It's a big troll.
It's a big troll. He's a fucking troll.
He's a Minotaur troll.
I have a room 237 level reading of that, which is that we've got, it's almost like a monkey's paw where you get the three wishes. He says he sells his soul for a drink. He gets a drink. He is talking about the old sperm bag upstairs. He ends up getting that beautiful woman who ends up being a hag, and then he's trapped in the freezer and he ends up getting out. So we've got the three wishes, which none of them really work out in anybody's favor.
Holy shit, let's make room 237 too.
So
I mean, it could be too that Danny let him out, right?
True.
It could be like what happened to Danny's neck earlier? We don't really
know,
right? Maybe Jack really did do that to him. And so there's this idea that somehow they're conspiring against one another because they sort of need each other in this traumatic struggle of trauma and violence that gets repeated within the human psyche. And so all of these needs for, like, did this objectively happen or was this subjective, are sort of collapsed into the idea that everything is a psychological subjective objectivity. So it's both. It's subjective and objective. Because it's subjectively in the psyche. That makes sense.
Yeah, the way that they set up that that whole thing with him, Jack, and Danny, and he's like, oh, I want to stay here forever and forever. And so, like, doubling the words of the twins, even though they're not supposed to be twins. And then that goes into Danny going into the room. So we never really see the assault, but then it's weird that it cuts before he actually can get into room 237 and see, like, because again, it's like mirrors galore inside of that room. And then, like, cut now to him wandering into the room. So it's almost like that entry into room 237 is the fantasy while he's being, you know, choked by Jack. I mean, that's one way to read it.
Yeah, so I wanted to go back to what Mike just said about the monkey's paw. And I was kind of interpreting some of the things going on as kind of like a, once again, Kubrick fucking with us by kind of hinting at like a Faustian kind of thing. So he says, I'd sell my soul for a goddamn beer, and then Lloyd immediately shows up. So we're meant to believe. And then later, when he's freaking out at Wendy, he says, when she says they should leave, but he says, I signed a contract, similar to Faust signing a contract with the devil in blood. And then maybe this one, Jack says, I'm the kind of man who likes to know who's buying his drinks, Lloyd. Mm. And Lloyd's like, that doesn't concern you. Is it the devil? A demon? I don't know. Once again, these are just more things that I think Kubrick is just like, maybe it's the devil. Maybe it's not. Ultimately, it doesn't make sense.
But it's Stephen King, too, remember? Because it's Kubrick playing with Stephen King's...
Kind of.
And I think Stephen King does the same thing. He trolls people, too. End up with
I haven't read the book, but I will say that the things that Kubrick is accomplishing here in thwarting our perspective or our ability to make sense of this is largely done formally through the medium of film, like in ways that Stephen King couldn't do through text.
And he hated the movie too.
Yeah, I wonder what he thinks about it now.
He doesn't like it.
He still doesn't like
it. Oh, he still hates it. Yeah, he thought that the TV version was like the definitive version.
I tried watching that.
Oh, that it's a rough watch.
Yeah.
One of the things that he hated about the original was the idea of Jack Nicholson playing Jack Torrance. And he's just like, well, he starts crazy and there's no place to go from there. You know, like, because Nicholson now had baggage from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and some of those earlier roles, that King just couldn't buy him in that place. And plus, you know, I mean, it's basically supposed to be a stand-in for Stephen King, right? And kind of like a wish fulfillment version of him with the hot blonde and all this kind of stuff. So I think that was an affront to him, the casting of Nicholson and the casting of Shelley Duvall.
Yeah, I was thinking, I'd heard that, and I was thinking about this last night, and as much as I love Jack Nicholson and as incredible as he is in this movie, I was thinking it would be such a different experience if it was a guy who is just, who seems like more of your average Joe, and then by the end becomes more Jack Nicholson manic. But I mean, I guess you're right. Whenever I think of Jack Nicholson, I think of The Joker, Easy Rider, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He's always a little bit on the crazy side.
So do you
want
think,
a Jason Bateman?
Do you think then that the Stephen King novel is more about what Ryan was saying, that it's more about isolation and the pitfalls of being a writer who needs to sit there and you get lost in your own imagination and kind of the descent into madness that takes place? Is that, do you think, more in the novel than maybe in the film, and that's why King didn't like it?
I haven't read
the
novel.
I also think that alcohol plays more of a part in the novel than it does in the film. I mean, yeah, there's a whole thing of him not drinking, and that does play kind of a theme in the movie, but it's nowhere near, like, we don't necessarily say the demon is alcohol. You know, we think about the Overlook, and the Overlook is the demon, but if we can kind of break through that and say, no, the real demon is alcohol, but I don't think we would ever get there with this film. I don't think we would ever say, no, the true bad guy of this is that he's taking a drink.
Oh, but Stephen King was trying to focus on that more in the book?
Well, that was, again, a personal thing for him, because he was quite a drinker for a time. And then eventually he would get hooked on pain pills after he got hit by a car. So he's always had substance abuse problems.
I mean, here's
so
the thing. I don't want to sound like a dick, but that's just far more boring than what Kubrick put together here. To try to be like, here's the problem, this is the demon, that to me again is my problem with Hereditary. It's too literal, man. Like, this is fucking art. Let's have some poetic openness here. And I think that
answers are for posers, man. Questions is where it's at.
Questions, bro. Questions.
Amen,
that's why I'm a
brother.
Philosopher.
So I want to talk about Jack. This time when I watched it, I really kind of focused on, and there are some really amazing things about Jack Nicholson's performance. One of the things is what I really appreciated this time is how the hotel kind of gives in to it. It not only represents his frustrations, but also represents and ultimately kind of gives him a little bit of his fantasy. So there are a couple times in the beginning. So first of all, we hear, actually, this is later in the movie. He says that he works at a car wash and shovels driveways and how Wendy fucked up his life. I really like this moment. Did this strike you guys? So the apartment that they're given, they keep on using these like kind of passive aggressive language, like looking at it like it's cozy and homey. Like, are they like, do they feel like, oh man, like this big hotel and you're giving us this shit room? Like, is there any indication of that? Did you guys get that at all?
I remember the moments you're talking about, but yeah, I didn't get that from that.
There's also when Jack is getting the tour guide tells him that all the people that stay at the hotel are all the best people. And then when he's there at the party scene in like the 1920s, like he's around these like what I would imagine are like these 1920s aristocrats. And he's so performative when he's talking to Lloyd. He's having this great time. He's usually dancing through the hallways as if he believes this is where I belong.
Yeah, there's a lovely class element in this film that I would love to do like just a singular Marxist reading of this film, because it clearly is playing with the idea of the working class versus the like bourgeois, right? And maybe the idea of the hominess of the room is feeding into that resentment that Jack already elicits with, he can't really hold down a job, he's kind of out of work, he used to teach just to make ends meet, but he wasn't proud of it, he didn't love it, it wasn't like a passion, it was something that he did just to get by, but really he's a struggling writer, and so he doesn't have the thing that he wants, he doesn't have the fulfillment of his desire, so he's not content. So there is an interesting class element that Kubrick is exploring here too.
And going back to a second ago, you praising Jack Nicholson's performance. If you there's some funny insight into that. If you watch Stanley Kubrick's daughter's like short documentary about the making of The Shining, called The Making of The Shining, I think everyone should go watch it. And you see Jack Nicholson in the back, because this was like a crazy over delayed shoot that went on and on and on. And they kind of were like, you know, art became reality because they were kind of all going crazy in the hotel. And you see Jack Nicholson just sitting there, like being like, I get a new script every day, and it just, I get to the set and it's a different script. So I just throw the things away in the morning. I just don't even read them anymore. You know, and he's just sitting there, and then he's just like pumping himself up with an axe. Like, you can tell he's just kind of like, I guess we're making some weird, scary movie and I'm going to go act crazy. And then Stanley Kubrick edited it together into this weird masterpiece.
Well, I heard something that I think is in that documentary, Ryan. You can tell me that the little boy, Danny, I don't remember what the actor's name is, but it's Danny something.
Danny Lloyd.
That he didn't know that he was in a horror film. That he thought he was just in like a hotel family drama. Which, when I watched the film, I'm like, but he's holding a knife and he's getting scared by these ghosts. How did he get that performance out of him if it wasn't a horror film? But what is that covered at all?
I don't believe so. I mean, he's in the
that
thing.
Seems
but
like more
really
IMDb trivia.
No, yeah. I've seen Danny Lloyd in person, and that's exactly what he had to say.
Right.
Oh, that's amazing.
Cool.
Well, there we go.
How the fuck? How?
Shit, man.
Like, what the fuck, man? Because the performance.
He's so young.
That kid's awesome. I was just going to say, we should take a moment to give a hand for Shelley Duvall in this movie. I mean, wow.
Dude, I have a
good
question.
Good job, Shelley.
I was watching this, and I was thinking to myself, is there something important that Danny the actor's character's name is Danny, that Jack the actor's name is Jack, but that Shelley the actor's name is not Shelley? Is there something important about that that is supposed to focus our attention on her character as Winifred or as Wendy?
Room 2372.
I don't know. I mean, is the names in the book, are they consistent?
Oh.
I don't know.
I think they are.
Yeah, then I probably wouldn't think too much into it.
Oh, well.
Anyway.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And plus, they... Halloran asks her two other names. He's like, are you a Winnie or are you like I can't remember what the
Freddy.
Other one
yeah.
is. And then she says, no, I'm a Wendy. It's like, oh, okay.
I think that could probably speak to more what Austin was talking about earlier with, like, you know, her just being the whatever, like his cum bucket or whatever. What is the word? He's
sperm bank.
Receptacle.
The old sperm bank.
Sperm bank. Yeah. My bad.
Cum bucket.
Yeah. I mean, they're,
what is the difference?
Well, there is something really interesting.
What is the difference?
Like, again, because there are all these different readings. Like, so, like, a class analysis reading would be interesting. A feminist reading would be interesting. A psychoanalytic reading. A mythical reading. I mean, there are all these different ways to look at this film. And I think this is what's so interesting about him as a filmmaker. Is he's able to encapsulate all of these motifs into a story that's also gripping. Where I think so many people, they try to be conceptual. And they lose out on interesting narrative or interesting story. And he's able to consistently do that. He's able to bridge that.
And can you just imagine him reading all those meanings and just cracking up?
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, he probably
what these people think this movie's about.
Right.
Yeah, there's a really nice YouTube video out there. The guy was not in Room 237. His name's Rob Ager, I think it is. And he does this whole reading about the gold room and how America was switching over from the gold standard at that time. So when Lloyd says your money's not good here anymore, your money's no good here, it's like, well, because that's like post gold standard. And it was actually really interesting. And plus, like, they talked about like the best people were here. And then he tries to figure out who some of those people are in the photo at the end. And he was like, well, this person looks like it was Woodrow Wilson's sister. And this is like, you know, Teddy Roosevelt's niece or whatever. And it's just like, okay, yeah, it gets real deep real quick, but he actually makes some good points.
Interesting.
See, this is what Room 237 should have answered but didn't, and it is why are people drawn to this film in particular and try and project meaning onto
it? Yeah, why do you think so? Kubrick's films, I think The Shining is probably this, or maybe like 2001 are the ones that people talk about the most. Not that they like the most necessarily.
Dude, on YouTube, people are crazy about The Eyes Wide Shut. Conspiracies.
Yeah. The Illuminati thing.
Oh,
yeah. I used to hate Room 237 until I talked to the filmmaker, and I was just like, I didn't say, like, why did you leave all the stupid stuff, like the kid coming in and interrupting the guy? But I was just like, you know, kind of talked to that point. And it was like, well, you know, the Shining's really about family, and I wanted to make sure that we got the families in there and stuff. And I was like, after talking to, what is it, Rodney Asher, I think, made the film, I was just like, okay, I respect this film a little bit more. To me, it's more of a movie about people who need better things to do. But yeah, yes, there's like a need to look for deeper meaning, because there's a lot of shit where they're just like, oh yeah, and if you look here, it looks like a, like he's got a big hard on and blah blah blah, and I'm like, whoa, what are you talking about? Like, that's a desk. What are you saying that because the guy moves around the desk, he's got a big hard on for Jack? I'm like, that's bizarre.
Yeah, Ryan, it would be like watching the King of Kong, but it only being Donkey Kong footage.
No, it is not.
yes, it is. It. All right, all right. Let's move on to the mailbag. So we got some emails regarding Star Wars. So if you guys haven't heard our rant on the Star Wars backlash, I don't think it's up on our Wise Cast channel yet. It's but it is on the RSS feed, so definitely go check that out. All right. So this one is from Justin. He says, while listening to the last episode of Show Me the Meaning, I got a little irked by the discussion of Admiral Holdo. This isn't really on you guys, but a lot of people complain about how she made a mistake by not telling Poe the plan. But this smells like utter bullshit. She doesn't tell him the plan because not only does he not need to know and is on a far lower link in the chain of command, but also because it's a little bit, fuck you, Flyboy. She is the Admiral and he needs to follow orders. The only reason the plan fails is because Poe sends Rose and Finn, who get betrayed by JD. The character Holdo is a little thin, but a strong one. If Michael Ironside or Clancy Brown played Holdo, I don't think we'd be hearing all this hate. How dare that shrill, bossy woman do her job? So, I get this, like, and that's, and I'm glad that he wrote this in, because I think that that is how we're supposed to read it, that Holdo, you know, like, yeah, like, we're supposed to say if he had just followed orders then everything would be okay. What do you guys think? I mean, because
I disagree. I mean, I agree that we're supposed to take it that way, but yeah. I think that the logic of the plan is so poorly, like, drawn out to the audience or portrayed to the audience that it seems like bad leadership, no matter
right.
her gender. You know, like, it just right. seems like, wait, what? Why'd you have to keep that for everybody? You know,
shouldn't she know that, like, there may be, like, dissent breeding among her ranks?
Right.
Like, you can't just ignore that and just say, well, it ought to be this way.
Yeah, exactly. So I get their point, but I disagree. I think that it was a poorly laid out plan.
Austin, anything on that?
I don't care. No, I really don't. I mean, wasn't so much that she was a bad leader or something like that, that she, all she had to do was just kind of explain to Poe, yo, dude, get in line. I got this secret bigger masterstroke. The biggest issue with Holdo was what the writer, who was that wrote the email?
This is from Justin.
That Justin said about, you know, that, oh, if this were, you know, a dude in this role, then we would have just kind of, like, taken it so seriously. How dare this, like, strong woman? But wasn't that kind of the point, is that the backlash against the film was kind of in that sort of, like, supposedly anti-woman sentiment, and that the backlash to the backlash was, wait a second, how dare you not just trust women? So then it's like the I trust woman thing. So isn't that more what we concentrated on than about, like, the foolishness of the plan? I don't know.
I don't know either. Anyway, moving on. So this next one is from Matt. He said, one big question I had about your discussion. You argue that Rian Johnson is more of an art house director in the fashion of Paul Thomas Anderson. If that's true, do you think, putting aside questions of Star Wars canon and diversity, that The Last Jedi works as a film? My opinion is that it does not. The pacing is boring, the tone is all over the place, and some of the promising characters from The Force Awakens are left in boring, pointless side plots. Yeah, I want to clarify here. I don't think that Rian Johnson is an art house director. I guess what I mean by that is, yeah, he's more concerned with making a piece of art that
cinematic director.
Yeah, something more cinematic than something that, you know, has a deep, compelling world with lore and plot and stuff like that. Yeah, and I think that he's bringing something up. Like, if he achieved that, then we wouldn't be having this conversation. It's a totally different thing. It's like, this is what he was going for, or this is how he fancies himself, and this is what he's actually able to achieve. And I would agree. I think that if the movie worked on the cinematic level that it was aspiring to, then, yeah, I don't think we'd be having this conversation.
Agreed.
All right. Well, that's it from us today. If you guys want to chime in with any of the discussion, you want to give us some thoughts on The Shining, hit us up at movies@wisecrack.com. I want to give a shout out to Mike White. Thank you so much for joining us, Mike.
Thank you so much, guys, for letting me be part of this discussion. I appreciate it.
Yeah, where can people find you? Tell us about your podcast.
I'm over at projection-booth.com, and yeah, every week we put out a new episode, or sometimes two, which is really stupid, but that's what I do. So
I've been doing it
for about 7 years.
So I mentioned this earlier, but I'm on his podcast on The Piano Teacher, which is an extremely deranged Michael Haneke film. And when is that coming out, Mike?
That should drop August 3rd.
August 3rd. I'll be looking forward to that. And where can we find everyone else on the internet? Ryan.
Ryan's game show and Ryan's shorts on YouTube and Facebook. I'm coming out with a short on Ryan's soda reviews, and then also a life hack on how to fly.
Cool. And Austin.
You can hit me up on Twitter, Austin_Hayden. I do a philosophy podcast called Owls at Dawn. And then I also actually do another movie podcast that I never talk about because I'm terrible with promoting myself. But it's called I Dig This Movie. And it's with a buddy of mine who's an award-winning director in London named Keir Seward. And he's got like an encyclopedic knowledge of film. And I'm just the douchey philosopher. So we talk about movies that we love.
Cool. Hit me up on Twitter @Wisecrack. Hit me up on Instagram @FatherOfWoody for the best dog pics in the biz. Also, want to just remind you guys, if you want to take place in our polls, if you want to be part of the conversation of what we cover, hit us up at wisecrackplus.com. Consider joining. It would mean a lot to us. And I know I'm asking a lot. If you guys have 3 minutes, please give us a review on iTunes. It can change the game for us.
Feels good.
And it feels good to do. I highly recommend it. And check out Ryan's short on WQ. It's his HQ parody. I've seen it like 10 times. It's fucking hilarious. All right, guys. That's it for us today. Next week, we're doing Network. So, hell yeah.
Fuck yeah.
All right. So, that's it for today. See you guys later. Peace.
Here's Wisecrack from Hollywood, California.
Peace, dudes.
Later.